Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Walt Sorg, sitting in for Jeff Timmer, who I think is still shoveling snow in West Michigan. Welcome to the non-liquid gold edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. 17% of Republicans in the corn-rich state of Iowa have spoken. Their message? Trump really won in 2020, but half of them don't want Trump in 2024. Meanwhile, the ex-president doubles down on his contention that a president does in fact have a license to kill. Michigan Republicans prepare for their presidential delegate selection convention, but can they afford the room rent? We may have a new contender in the race for the U.S. Senate nomination, as new polling shows the leader is some dude named Undecided.
And I'm Mark Brewer. Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson steps into the redistricting controversy, asking the United States Supreme Court to delay redrawing of the districts for this election. The U.S. Supreme Court sidesteps the first of a series of anti-transgender American lawsuits. A few statewide polls show Biden with a narrow lead over Trump. Is it an outlier or is it representative?
Let's start, Mark, with what I think is the headline of the week, maybe the headline of the month. This from Mother Jones. The headline reads, Florida man facing 91 criminal counts wins Iowa caucuses. That's an interesting way to look at it, but they're very accurate.
Yeah, no, it is a very accurate in terms of stating the facts. Yeah, look, our listeners know by now, Trump took a little over half the vote in Iowa, which by Iowa standards is an extraordinary performance to win by that large a margin. But I think some mixed signals there. As you pointed out in the opening, well, that means half of Iowa Republicans who showed up for the caucuses, by the way, which are very low turnout events, even when there isn't a blizzard like there was last week. But half of Iowa Republicans voted for another candidate in that race. So while it appears that Trump does have a strong hold on the Iowa Party and Republican parties throughout the country, it's not ironclad. There, again, half the Republicans who showed up, who've got to be the diehard, said they wanted another candidate. Now, will they coalesce around Trump if he's the nominee? Likely so, but we've got a lot of events coming. And again, that headline that you just mentioned about 91 criminal counts, all these lawsuits, whether it be for defamation in New York or business fraud in New York, or the various criminal charges that are pending in Georgia and in the federal courts, polls indicate that may have an impact, a negative impact on Trump if he ends up getting convicted in one or more of those things. But Walt, you are a longtime political activist, not only here in Michigan, but elsewhere. What's your take on what happened in Iowa this week?
I found it intriguing that the polling, they did some entrance polling rather than exit polling of people attending the caucuses. And these are the hardcore. These are hardcore Republicans, true believers, and just under a third of them said that if Trump is convicted of a felony, they don't think he's qualified to be president. And if I were Donald Trump, I'd really be worried about that. Clearly, his strategy all along has been to delay, so it's after the election. So for him, all of these hearings that are coming up, the Supreme Court hearing on whether he can actually be charged or if he truly does have a license to kill, that is important to him. Plus, the delay he's getting in Florida from a very friendly federal judge that he appointed. Clearly, that trial is not going to happen until after the election because she'll figure out everything she can to delay that trial. So the big one is still going to be the one in D.C. over January 6th. And if that happens before the election and he is convicted, that could have a huge impact on the general election. The other thing that I found intriguing about this whole situation, as while this was going on, there was a new survey, the monthly survey from the University of Michigan on consumer sentiment, and consumers are getting more and more enthusiastic about the state of the economy. They're not attaching it maybe yet to Joe Biden, but that's what a campaign is about. But they say it has really been a record improvement over the last couple of months as inflation is coming down, wages are going up, and the jobless rate continues to be very low. A lot of good things are happening in the economy. I've been saying all along that it takes a while for perception to catch up with reality. The perception is beginning to catch up, and it's coming 10 months before the election, which is great timing for Joe Biden, unless something happens, like inflation goes back up again because of the problems they're having with the shipping in the Middle East, or we have some calamity we don't know about. But it's looking better and better for Joe Biden, despite truly bad numbers.
Yeah, no, I agree. The numbers are creeping up, and that's good news for Biden. It'll take a few. I think the political perception, the political impact of those increased numbers will lag a few months. But also, I think we need to be realistic here. Trump won in 2016 in a strong economy. Obviously, the incumbency factor wasn't there in terms of there was not a Democratic incumbent like Biden. On balance, I agree with you that the economic news looks good for Biden, but obviously it's no guarantee. I still think we're going to have a very close election here. Let's go back to looking forward now on the Republican presidential race. So we have DeSantis finishing a distant second, but he did finish second, which kind of blunted some of Haley's momentum. DeSantis appears to be basically abandoning New Hampshire, focusing on Carolina. Haley finishes third in Iowa and rushes over to New Hampshire, where polls show she might do okay, which apparently has prompted Trump to really unload on Haley this past week, including a full barrage of racism. So, Walt, what's your take on what's going on in New Hampshire, and what might we see on Tuesday?
I think it's almost irrelevant unless Haley actually wins, which the polling indicates that she will not. You've got to win somewhere to win the nomination. And even in a two-person race, it looks like Trump will pull it out. And then when you get to South Carolina, Trump has a huge lead, even though she's the former governor of South Carolina. And DeSantis is in single digits in the polling in South Carolina. So it looks to me, at least, like this whole thing is over in South Carolina, just as it was for Democrats 4 years ago when Joe Biden came off of two bad losses in Iowa and New Hampshire. He got the endorsement that he needed in South Carolina, won the primary, and a week later, he was the presumptive nominee. I think it's going to be the same case with Trump. And that, I think, will focus people on the rematch. They're going to stop complaining about we don't want Biden against Trump. Well, if you don't like it, you got it. And then I think maybe the attention goes to what happens with these third parties, especially the no labels people. Are they going to actually do what they've promised to do? And that is step aside if the polling shows that they can't win.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, I think there's still a lot of fantasizing in both parties that it may not be Biden versus Trump. I think the Iowa results started to remove that fantasy a little bit. If Trump wins New Hampshire and then goes on to win Carolina, this is over. I think Jeff is not going to be predicting for months. It has been over, and I've generally agreed with that. When you've got election results, that indicates that it is over. So we could very well soon have an indisputable Biden versus Trump race. I want to ask you, have DeSantis or Haley done anything you think to disqualify themselves from being the vice presidential candidate on a Trump ticket?
Absolutely. Both of them have been disdainful lately out of desperation of Trump, especially Haley, who in the last couple of days has raised the issue of whether or not Trump is mentally competent to be president. And he has demonstrated time after time in his speeches to his rallies that he may be losing it a little bit. My mom passed away from Alzheimer's, and what I see in Donald Trump is what I saw in my mom in the early stages of Alzheimer's. A little delusional, saying really wacky things. And just yesterday, he confused Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi and accused Nikki Haley of failing on security of the Capitol on January 6th. I don't know what the hell Nikki Haley had to do with the Capitol on January 6th, but he's done that a lot lately. He's confused. A couple of times he's talked about how he beat Barack Obama in 2016. He may very well be losing it. And he's the master of projection anyway. And when he keeps saying that Joe Biden is over the hill mentally, that could be a sign that maybe Trump believes he's over the hill mentally. He calls him Crooked Joe, yet it's Trump with the 91 felony indictments. It's classic with Trump. If he's done something, he accuses the other side of being just as bad or worse on the same issue.
Yeah, no, I think we might see some of those salient quotes in the fall general election campaign. She went after Trump. We won't see her. We won't see these statements. She went after Trump this week on age. We won't see those in the fall, but the cognitive attacks that she made on him this week. And you're right, yesterday, it wasn't once that Trump confused Haley with Pelosi, but six times in the same speech. So it wasn't inadvertent. It happened repeatedly. So yeah, no, I think you're right. I think Haley's, in some cases, she's been defending herself from some pretty vicious attacks by Trump, but she's probably said some unforgivable things at this point, at least in terms of Trump and putting somebody on the ticket. But he's got other alternatives. He's got Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, I believe it is, and others who I think he can put on the ticket. So we'll see how that plays itself out as we turn to the Veep Stakes, as they call it.
More with Mark and Walt after these messages on A Republic, If You Can Keep It.
One thing I have learned in politics, not all pollsters are equal. There are a lot of bad polls and a small number of good ones. And that's why Epic MRA stands out. Epic MRA has been measuring Michigan public opinion for more than four decades. The company has earned a national reputation for integrity and accuracy. In fact, it is rated as the best polling company in Michigan by 538.com. The 2022 election is the latest example of why political professionals rely on Epic MRA. While a lot of other pollsters were calling the key races toss-ups, Epic MRA accurately reported that it looked like a Democratic sweep. And they also reported that the three ballot proposals would all win decisively, which is exactly what happened. It's not just politics. Epic MRA has been the go-to pollster for school districts, local governments, and independent groups who need to know what the public is thinking. If anyone asks me, I'm happy to recommend Epic MRA. For the best in public opinion research, head to epicmra.com.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Well, I want to completely change the topic here. A frequent guest of ours, former U.S. Attorney in Detroit, Barbara McQuaid, who's quite the national commentator. I see her regularly on the national talk shows, a very expert commentator. She's a terrific resource. Is coming out with a book on disinformation and its terrible impact on American politics, including some of her proposed solutions. I'm about to buy the book, so I'm looking forward to that. But it sounds like it's a very timely book from somebody who's pretty influential in this field. What are your thoughts on Barb McQuaid's book?
I love Barb McQuaid, even though she is a University of Michigan professor. Spartan anger goes deep, but Barb's one of the good guys from the University of Michigan. The book is called Attack from Within. She's brilliant. I listened to her podcast, hashtag Sisters-in-Law, which is really a fabulous podcast, highly recommended. And I'm sure her book will be just as good. She does teach at the University of Michigan. She's a regular on MSNBC, former U.S. District Attorney in Detroit, and just a very engaging woman. If I was going to law school, I'd sure want her class. And like you, I'm going to be getting her book, and I don't buy a whole lot of books. I think this is the first book we've ever promoted on this podcast, unless it was a book written by our guest of the week. And Barb's not here this week.
That's right, but we do hope to get her back. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to reading that book. That's a very important topic. Last year, the legislature passed a couple of laws to try to deal with disinformation, requiring disclaimers and putting other restrictions. And it's widely perceived, and there's reports out on this, and there have been congressional hearings, that disinformation, AI, deep fakes are going to be an even more prominent feature of this year's elections and future elections. And it's a real serious threat to American democracy. So I think Barb is very prescient here in terms of, obviously, you don't write a book off the cuff like this. So she saw this coming some time ago and put pen to paper. And I, like you, I'm looking forward to reading that. Another favorite topic, and I know, again, you were involved in helping to bring about this massive reform of Michigan's redistricting process, but it seems like it never ends, Walt, as the Redistricting Commission this week began several week, very intensive process of trying to fix the Detroit maps. They met virtually every day this week. I think they're going to meet in person next week in Detroit to continue redrawing these maps. Have you had a chance to watch any of that, Walt, or absorb the press coverage? What do you think is going to happen here?
I think they've got a tremendous task ahead of them because of the timing. The calendar for elections is like a Jenga puzzle, because if you move one piece of it, the whole thing has to be readjusted. And that's why Secretary of State Benson has gotten involved. She's not dealing with the substance of the redrawing. She's dealing with the practicalities of holding a primary election in August, which means she's got a deadline for getting ballots out. There's a deadline for candidates to file. There's a deadline for updating the voter list. There's just a lot of mechanical things that have to be done. And if the maps come too late, she runs into the problem of perhaps not being able to do all the things she needs to do within the Bureau of Elections to get ready for the August primary and for the November general election. So she's asking the Supreme Court, hey, give us a little time. Let's not make this effective until the 26th cycle. And so we'll stick with the districts we have for now. In terms of the practical damage that happened in these seven House districts that they want redrawn for the next election, several of them already have African-American legislators, including the Speaker of the House. One of the districts is his. So it is not as bad in terms of the outcome as it is on paper in terms of how the districts were drawn. In terms of the process itself, it's still, to me, better. It's not perfect, but it is better than having the legislature do it. The legislature has proven time after time, and you were involved, Jeff was involved. It became a partisan battle, and this is cleaner. One of the discussions we had when we were working on the constitutional amendment was, there will be no perfect system. It is impossible to have a perfect system. We still believe this is about as close as we can get to a perfect system. Some tweaks are needed to the constitutional amendment, but nothing major. The system's working pretty much the way it was envisioned. So I'm optimistic.
Well, on the big picture you described, but I agree with you. And I've been cautioning people. I was on a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and people were very critical of the ICRC. I said, look, there are some defects, some pieces need to be fixed, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, was the phrase I used. Because this system, it's still got its flaws, is far better than the partisan gerrymandering that we saw over the last several decades. In terms of what's going on with the commission, they are really neck deep into this process. As of yesterday, they had at least six different House maps they were working on, affecting up to 13 different districts. So they're already well beyond the seven the court ordered them to redraw. Some of that is inevitable, because there are neighboring districts that may need to be incorporated when you're doing some redrawing. But I hope, and I think they can and should, focus on getting the seven corrected with as little spillover effect in the other districts. They're all under a very tight deadline. I think it's by the end of next week, they have to put a draft plans out for public comment during March. And so the deadlines are coming quickly upon them. The court wants to finish the whole process by the end of March. But as you pointed out, that has given Secretary Benson and the election folks involved in the Detroit area real heartburn. And that's why they've asked the Supreme Court to slow the process down, leave the districts in place for 24, so that we have time to make these changes and make them work effectively for 26. But there's a lot of balls in the air, a lot of things going on simultaneously here. That's a fascinating process, and we'll see how it plays out, and we'll keep our listeners informed as we go on. I thought, Walt, there was a really interesting development in the U.S. Senate race this week. The Republican field, maybe the Republican field, but maybe another field, keeps expanding with former Rep. Justin Amash announcing that he was going to be a candidate. I don't think it was clear he was going to get into the Republican race. He's certainly not going to run as a Democrat. But what's your take on Justin Amash? What does he see in what's going on in the Republican primary or otherwise that Lee seemed to believe he's got an opening here.
One thing I'll say for Justin Amash, I don't agree with him politically on just about anything, but I think he is probably the most principled person that I've seen in a long time in the Republican Party in Michigan. The man is very true to his beliefs. He's very open. When he was a member of Congress, he used to post on Facebook every time he voted, how he voted on an issue right away so people could see he would explain why he voted. In terms of being a candidate on the Republican side, he's got a real problem. He was the first Republican in Congress to cite Donald Trump for impeachable conduct. And this was during impeachment one, back when Trump was messing with Ukraine and trying to get Ukraine to come up with some dirt on the Biden family. And Donald Trump's got a long memory. He is definitely not going to support Justin Amash. I would be surprised if he even supported him if Amash got the nomination, which is probably a long shot. He's in a smaller field on the Republican side simply because he is not buying into Trump so far, at least. And given his history of being a pretty straight shooter, I doubt that he would endorse Donald Trump, even if Trump were the nominee. So if he runs as an independent, that would be great for Alyssa Slotkin. It would take a lot of votes away from the Republican candidate, whomever it is, whether it's the chief or it's Mike Rogers or it's one of the other people that are running. And it would be a good thing for Alyssa Slotkin. And I don't think Amash can win a Republican primary unless you get like 40 people running. Although we're getting close to that number.
Yeah, that number keeps growing there. I agree with your assessment of Amash in terms of he has been true to his principles, very consistent in terms of how he voted and what he said about things, whether you agree with him or not. He certainly has that going for him. If he gets into the Republican primary, he will be the only candidate who either has never criticized Trump or hasn't repudiated their prior criticism, as Mike Rogers has done. That guy has made such a 180. He used to be so critical of Trump, but now he's an apologist for Trump, because I think he realized once he got into the primary, he has no hope of winning a primary as an anti-Trump candidate. I see Rogers now has ads on the air. I see them in the local diner in my neighborhood where I often have dinner. But it's interesting that even in those ads, he talks about how he's a former member of law enforcement. He doesn't say FBI, because the FBI is part of the deep state, right, that the Trump supporters don't like. So he's very carefully stepping around parts of his biography, even as that race heats up. Yeah, we'll see what happens with Amash. Maybe he does in the end decide to be an independent. Wasn't he briefly an independent in the Congress, Walt? And certainly after he left Congress? Yeah.
Yeah, and I think he stopped caucusing with the Republicans when he decided to become an independent in Congress. But a few months later, he was gone. He did not seek re-election.
Yeah, so there's a history there. He was always a kind of a libertarian-leaning Republican anyway, and showed a streak of independence. So I don't think an independent run for Senate for him is beyond the realm of possibility.
And he can raise some money. He's got a constituency out there, and he could be a real factor, much to the benefit, I think, though, of Alyssa Slotkin. I think it would almost guarantee that she would win that race. Wanted to go back to something that we talked about in the open, and that is the Republican presidential nominating convention that is set for just down the road in Detroit. We've got a story this week that the Republican Party has defaulted on a $500,000 loan. They are more than broke now, and they could be in court with the Comerica Bank for collection. And they've got no assets. It's, as you and Jeff have discussed, they don't even own their own headquarters. So they've really got nothing other than a mailing list, and I'm not sure Comerica needs that. So can they pay the bill? But also, you've still got this fight over who runs the party. You've got lawsuits being filed by the challengers. You've got the current, we think she's chair, sending out a letter calling on Republicans to stop saying nasty things about her. And it's a total mess. And for Democrats like us, it's a lot of fun.
This is going to come to a head. As you point out, we're recording on Saturday. Yesterday, Friday, the PAYGO Corral faction, the group that allegedly ousted Cromwell a few weeks ago and made PAYGO the interim chair, filed a lawsuit in the Kent County Circuit Court to try to resolve this dispute, who's the legitimate chair. And then today, just before we started this podcast, that faction elected former Congressman Pete Hoekstra as its chair. As I tweeted, though, what's the old French phrase? plus ça change, plus la même chose. The more things change, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Hoekstra, at this point in his life, is a avid pro-Trumper, so nothing changed from that perspective in terms of that faction. They've always been pro-Trump, and they're now being led by a pro-Trump person. He does have a little bit more of an establishment background, a lot more credibility, I would assume, with the donor class than Karamo has. But they've got a leader now. And as you point out, though, it's going to come to a head here, not just through this lawsuit, but who's going to run these conventions to select delegates. And those will occur in March. After we get through the presidential primary at the end of February, in March, they're supposed to gather, I think, in Detroit at the former TCF Center, now the Huntington Center, and elect their delegates. Who's going to pay the bills? Who's going to be in charge of all of that? Who knows? We may need a vivid or a pretty strong police presence at the TCF Center, the Huntington Center, come March. Try to keep order between these factions. We've seen fights at prior state central meetings of the Republican Party, which resulted in police reports and some criminal prosecutions, I think. And I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility that we could have some physical altercations at these conventions in March. It's really remarkable. I would say as a former chair, it's a chair's worst nightmare that this kind of thing happens, right? It's completely antithetical to your mission, way off message. In one sense, I've said this before, this is very sad to see a major political party deteriorate and fall apart like this. We need two healthy political parties in this state, in this country, to have a good political system. And that role is not being fulfilled by the current Republican Party. Walt, have you ever seen anything approaching this in Michigan politics? Do you have any sense how this might end?
I was thinking back in my Wayback Machine to one of the first major stories I covered as a very young reporter. That's way back in 1968, when there was a huge split in the Democratic Party between the factions supporting Vice President Hubert Humphrey for the presidential nomination, and that was the regulars of the party. And then you had the insurgents led by the chair of the Democratic Party, Zoltan Ferenczi, and they were campaigning for Eugene McCarthy. They would have been with Bobby Kennedy. Of course, he had been assassinated 2 months prior to the convention. And that got pretty bitter, and I couldn't remember, and I'm still trying to track down whether they actually had competing slates of delegates at the convention, but I know there was a lot of controversy, and the late, very great Phil Hart did his very best to bring the two sides together. Ultimately, Humphrey did win the state of Michigan. Zoltan Ferenczi was one of the presidential electors who was elected in that election, and he refused to vote for Humphrey. He just sat back and says, no, I'm not casting my vote for him. I don't recall whether he voted for McCarthy or he just sat it out. But Zoltan, who was known as the Happy Hungarian, was the leader of a tremendous fight within the party. But it didn't split the party where they had competition as to who was running the party. Zoltan stepped down as chair. He was replaced by Sandy Levin, who was running for governor at the time, which makes for a very heavy lift. And probably the biggest problem for Sandy was he was running against Bill Milliken. And then, quite honestly, there was a lot of tension when you had a fight to be reelected chair. I hate to bring it up because you lost the fight. That was quite contentious, too, but it didn't split the party like the Republicans are split today. It was a tough fight, and ultimately, you just graciously read the tea leaves and stepped down.
Yeah, no, in the Democratic Party, we've never had something that has gone anywhere near as far as we've seen in the Republican Party. And even at the local level, lawsuits, factions fighting over control of the party. It really is extraordinary. Democrats, we've had our fights, some pretty vigorous, vicious internal fights over the years, but we've always hung together as a party. And the events you recite from the 60s actually led to some significant reforms in the Democratic Party in terms of how delegates were picked. And the 72 convention was very different from the 68 convention in terms of who the delegates were and how they were selected. Yeah, so sorry for our listeners for this trip down memory lane back to the 1960s, but that just shows you the extraordinary territory we are in with the Republican Party. Who knows if there are going to be lawsuits over trying to stop these conventions in March? Are they going to ask that Kent County Circuit Judge, who's got this initial lawsuit, to step in and play referee? There's just lots of different directions this could go. It's going to be a real problem for the state officials if come August, it's not clear who the Republican nominees are coming out of their August nominating convention. That puts Secretary Benson in a real tough spot if she's forced to choose between factions of the Republican Party. I hope it doesn't come to that from an institutional perspective, but we've seen that happen in the past in other states. Minor parties in Michigan have sometimes presented competing slates, but that hasn't caused remotely the problem it would cause here in Michigan if we have those competing slates. But we'll, as we've done over the months, this has played itself out. I'm sure we'll be talking about this again.
One more item before we say goodbye, and that is this poll that came out from Target Insight that was done on behalf of a TV station in Detroit, and that found a slight lead for the president over Donald Trump in Michigan, quite different than what we had with the Epic MRA polling, which showed Trump and Nikki Haley both with substantial leads over the president. What do you make of this? Is it an outlier or is it a sign that maybe things are improving for the president?
I don't think you can say either, frankly. What I do with polls, and then we had Tom Bonier on a few weeks ago, and I thought it was very insightful. I really looked to him for guidance on things. I tend to look at averages of what I consider good polls. And that means you got to look into each poll. You got to see its methodology, take a look at their turnout projections, right? Because that's what all this polling is based on. Who's going to turn out in the fall of 2024? And if you're a pollster and you make a slight, small, even a small mistake in terms of your turnout projection, your poll could be dramatically wrong, quote unquote. So I'm not guided by any individual poll, but I will look at averages of good polls over the course of time. And even then, again, these are nothing but snapshots in time. They're not predictors. And there are a lot of events, obviously, between now and November. I'm sorry to give our listeners so many caveats, but we've become such a poll-driven polity that people just, they miss the forest for the trees. And they don't understand that these individual polls, frankly, are relatively meaningless in the scheme of things. It's only when aggregated with good data and you look at trends and so forth that you really can gain anything out of them. So I'm sorry. I know the media is very obsessed with them. They pay a lot of money to pollsters so they can run headlines and generate readership. But I think in terms of actual information, there's not a lot there.
But they do have a lot of power. For all practical purposes, the Republican race for president is over after two very non-representative states, very white, very small, will have voted. And everything else is based on polls. And there's a good chance that after we get done with New Hampshire on Tuesday, it's all over. And certainly after South Carolina, it's going to be over.
There's no question these polls have influence, right? Donors look at them. And I and others like me are dealing with donors all the time who either are panicked or giddy or complacent based on a poll or a couple of polls. And you have to talk some sense into them, some sense of realism into them. So they certainly have an influence. I don't deny that. It's usually a bad influence in terms of making people making decisions based on information that they shouldn't be based on. But I want to, your point about Iowa and New Hampshire, why do you think that, and that is why the Democratic Party stopped using those two states as the first two states. They are not representative of this country. And I think what's going on with Trump, apropos of your point there, Walt, proves exactly that point, that elections, particularly nominations of any party, should not be determined by the results in Iowa and New Hampshire. But that's the path the Republican Party continues to go down. Thank goodness the Democrats had the sense to get off that path and include states like Michigan in the mix.
Before we wrap up for this week, why don't we get into the subject, a day in the life of Mark Brewer, specifically what you spent all day yesterday doing.
Yeah, no, this came up as interesting. At the board meeting, one of the board members welcomed me. And
this is the State Board of Canvassers.
State Board of Canvassers, and made a comment about how I frequently appear before that board. And I told them, and I meant this, that I'm very blessed in my legal practice. I have fascinating clients, devoted clients, interesting cases. But yeah, I was before the Board of Canvassers yesterday on two ballot proposals, one which would end property taxation in this state, which would essentially defund the public schools, community colleges, a lot of other functions of government without any replacement revenue. Local governments would also lose their property tax base, which is really important under the proposal, they would get a little replacement revenue from the state, but not anywhere near enough. And so I was one of the lawyers for the opponents to this proposal, and we were urging the board in its summary of the proposal, which will go on the petitions, which are going to circulate, to describe to the voters the consequences, these terrible economic consequences of signing that petition and putting this on the ballot. And we were somewhat successful in that effort yesterday. The summary will indicate that this will remove funding for public schools and community colleges and so forth. So that's the job of an advocate, try to get their client's viewpoint into these petitions. The other one that I was involved in is an attempt now to repeal part of the Democrats and the governor's energy package from last year. And this is the part of the package that allows the Public Service Commission to site, that's S-I-T-E, energy facilities, wind and solar facilities in particular, when you've got local jurisdictions who are engaging in NIMBYism, that they are saying, oh, no, we don't want these, and we don't care if the farmers or the property owners want to develop them. A small minority can use the zoning ordinances and so forth to block those things. So there's a group of folks now who want to repeal the statewide standards and the power of the PSC to step in if necessary. And so we're fighting over that. And one of the things, again, that we wanted to point out were the adverse consequences of repealing this law. This law is full, Walt, of all kinds of great things. It's got setback and height restrictions on these facilities, protections for workers, financial benefits for local communities. So this law has, and I think will have, a lot of benefits, going to create a lot of jobs. And we were able to, in the summary of the petition that was adopted, insert some of those benefits so that when signers of this petition sign it, they'll know, this is what I'm signing up for. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but these are nuts and bolts things that I do in my practice and frankly can have a very big practical impact on whether proposals like this get on the ballot.
And if any of our listeners have a proposal they'd like on the ballot, you can contact Mark through our website he's got the time to take it on with all the things he's doing.
Thank you, Al. You're very kind. That's not the purpose of this podcast. I've enjoyed working with you and Jeff now for over 2 years and having these conversations every week. And occasionally, we talk about my practice when it's newsworthy. Thank you, though, Walt.
It's nice to get the answers directly from one of the people that's part of the decision-making process.
And with that, we'll close out show number 3 of 2024. Next week, Jeff returns for our post-New Hampshire pod and whatever else occurs during the next week.
The big question, will it be the end for Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis? Or does the one-sided fight continue in South Carolina and end there?
But no matter what the uncertainties of politics in Michigan and in the country, there is one thing that's reasonably certain. If the Republic is still standing next week, Jeff and I will be back with the assistance of our fabulous producer and co-host today, Walt Sorg. Thank you for sharing part of your day with us.
A Republic, If You Can Keep It, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each, then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.